I've never met anyone like it.
He could hack anybody's phone in a matter of minutes. Who is that guy? Who can do that?
Talos is the most interesting man in the world.
He's one of my favorite people on the planet. Inventor.
Wicked smart.
The master of cutting corners.
If you had a dead body in your trunk, who would you call?
He would get arrested immediately in a lineup.
I stood in line to get his autograph.
You know, his mouth can barely keep up his brain.
I don't actually know what Talos does.
A hacker magician.
Man of the future. Future.
One of the things I think is super unique about you, there's maybe, in my estimation, maybe like 100 people on Earth who both understand cryptography and know how to code.
Right.
That 100 people is not a lot. And especially these days, in some sense, like for the first time ever, a lot of interest in the crypto toolkit because of Bitcoin. And so I want to ask you a bunch of questions about that stuff. And, you know, I think certainly you and I both have had an interest in cryptography. Mine goes back about 20 years. Yours is probably even more than that. And then you have a super deep math background. And so I've always thought of you as like the, of all the people I know, probably the one who has the deepest understanding practically of what it means to implement this stuff, how hard that is to get it right, how easy it is to get it wrong. And so now we have this situation where, because of Bitcoin, people have gotten wildly excited about what they call crypto.
Right.
But what they really mean is currency speculation.
Yeah.
Because, you know, everybody likes to gamble, and this has been the most winningest gambling that's been going on lately. And so now it seems to me like anybody who has any knowledge at all about crypto is tied up making some alternative to Bitcoin or some other like blockchain related project. I'm curious what you think about that stuff. We don't have to talk about the mechanics of blockchain or Bitcoin. I think that's been done to death. But I'm curious what you think of the state of society right now and the frenzy that we're in over blockchain. And I'm going to try not to jump in with my opinion here.
So I think there's lots of things to say about blockchain. Yeah, the first thing to say about blockchain is that I don't think anybody knows what they mean when they say blockchain. I think blockchain is this kind of magic math stuff that's going to make us all rich.
Right.
You know, it's going to equalize society. I think this is all sort of nonsense, but I think that there's... So, you know, one of the things I like to say about Bitcoin is that there's really two things going on. And there's one incredibly stupid thing.
Yeah.
And there's one very sensible thing.
Yeah.
And the incredibly stupid thing is I'm going to take a $100 bill and I'm going to burn it and I'm going to bottle the smoke. And now you should believe that that bottle of smoke is worth $100. And I just
okay.
I just think that's nonsense, right?
Okay.
But then I think there's a second thing going on, which is that I'm going to produce this like verifiable ledger of stuff.
Yeah.
And, you know, that verifiable ledger has cryptographic certainty about it. And I think those verifiable ledgers are actually very useful.
Yeah.
And in fact, what I've done for the last 5-6 years now is trying to build the sensible part of that. So these verifiable ledgers. So that's what certificate of transparency is. You know, I've resisted calling it blockchain for a long time.
Yeah.
Because as soon as I say, you know, I'm doing blockchain, everyone's like, oh, so now you like Bitcoin.
Yeah.
I'm like, no. I don't like Bitcoin. But I do like this idea of verifiable ledgers. And so I think the interesting question is, you know, what is interesting about verifiable ledgers? And I think there's the... So a lot of people are just like, well, you could take Bitcoin or, you know, and almost any blockchain project and just say, I've got a database.
Yeah.
And you'd be doing the same thing. And so what's really different between a database and a verifiable ledger? And I think what's really different is that it's a thing that you can not only, you know, say, here is a database of stuff, but also... here are cryptographic proofs that the stuff actually is in the ledger and that the ledger has this append-only property.
Yeah.
And that you can't go back and lie about what, you know, what it used to say or what it does say. And if you ever do, then you get a checkable proof that you have lied.
Yeah. Right?
And so, you know, certificate transparency, and I can explain what certificate transparency is if that would be helpful.
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay, so certificate transparency is basically, well, a bit of ancient history. In November 2011,
yeah,
a certification authority, so they're basically the people who are responsible for issuing certificates for SSL.
Yeah.
And so, you know, when you go to Amazon and you get the little padlock that says you really are at Amazon,
yeah,
the reason you get the padlock is because a certification authority has said this public key corresponds to Amazon.
Yeah.
And then the site you've connected to proves that it has possession of the private key that corresponds to the public key.
Yeah.
And now you're like, you have a secure connection with Amazon, but you're relying on that certification authority to actually get it right.
Yeah.
And not let some other person claim to be Amazon or claim to be Google or whatever. And in November 2011, DigiNotar, who are a certification authority, issued, or rather it became apparent that they had issued 500 certificates for websites that they should not have issued certificates for. And those were basically all of the really popular websites.
Yeah.
So, you know, Amazon, Google, Microsoft, Yahoo, Facebook, you know, everything you can think of.
Right.
And those were then used by the Iranian government to do man-in-the-middle attacks on Iranian systems. And, so two things were interesting about that. One is that that attack kind of existed in the wild for 2 months without anybody knowing it was going on.
Mm-hmm.
So that was bad in itself. But the second thing was that nobody ever really knew what the complete list of certificates that they had issued was.
Right.
And so the aftermath
was,
okay, this certificate authority has issued all of these certificates that they shouldn't have done. What do we do about it? There's really no alternative other than to say we have to distrust every certificate ever issued by this certificate authority.
Yeah.
As it happens, DigiNotar were also the Dutch governmental CA.
Okay.
So they were also issuing all the certificates that the Dutch government used for various things.
Yeah.
So when we shut them down and distrusted all of their certificates, this was bad news if you were Dutch. So there were a bunch of knock-on things. The three I happen to know about, whether you could no longer buy or sell cars because you couldn't register the sale anymore.
In Holland.
In Holland, yeah. The ability to electronically clear customs went away. So, you know, like bulk imports stalled because you couldn't clear customs.
Right, okay.
And they also lost the ability to buy and sell electricity on the international markets. And so, you know, this is a mess.
Yeah. Right?
And so the question arose is, well, what could we do about that? Now, as it happens, now, when we started Certificate Transparency, this is not a story I could tell because the underlying reason for us thinking about this was a secret, and that was that Google was making a certificate authority.
Right.
We had decided internally that if we were going to do this, we should make it transparent.
Right.
So we should publish all the certificates that we issued so that people could check that we had issued them correctly.
Right.
And I had proposed that we could not just publish it, but we could do it in a provable way.
Yeah.
So using these verifiable ledgers.
Yeah.
So we could commit to certificates that we'd issued, and we could even close the loop so that the browser actually checked that we really had committed, that it really was in the log. And so we just couldn't issue a certificate that was accepted by a browser that had not been published. Right? And so the cool thing about publishing it in these verifiable logs was that then you could make the claim that if a certificate issued, if you saw a certificate and you had a proof that it was in the log, then you also knew that the owner of that domain could see it in the log as well.
Yep.
And so if it had been incorrectly issued, they would have an opportunity to notice that and they could revoke it. So suddenly you were not in this position
where
there could be these things floating around in the wild that you just didn't know whether it was really Amazon or really Google or not. And so we'd had this idea for our own CA prior to DigiNotar. And when DigiNotar happened, I went to my bosses at Google and said, hey, you know, we could just do this for every CA.
Yeah, right.
Like, Well, that's a good idea.
Yeah, right.
Off you go and make it happen. So 6.5 years down the line.
Yeah.
Yeah, we've actually done that.
Okay.
And we've got all of the CAs to sign up to it. And from April the 30th this year, and Firefox are all going to require that every certificate that they see has actually been published in one of these public logs.
Great.
So that's interesting in itself.
Sure.
And if you imagine a world where DigiNotar had occurred after we had done that,
yep.
then not only... So DigiNotar, they were hacked, and that's why
this certificate
got issued. There was like 2 months between them getting hacked and us, anyone becoming aware that this had occurred.
Right.
So we'd bring that down to like 1 day instead of 2 months.
Yeah.
Plus, instead of having to shut down the whole CA, we would actually have a complete list mm-hmm. of all the certificates that they'd issued. And we'd be able to say, these are all the ones that were bad.
Right.
We could just blacklist those. The rest could continue to function.
Great.
We would not have caused all that chaos in the sort of Dutch ecosystem. So I think that's interesting.
Yeah.
Another thing that's interesting is that publishing these logs caused this kind of ecosystem of analysis around certificates that had not occurred before.
Yeah.
Even though they're public. You can crawl the net.
Yeah.
A list of them. People have done it before. Mm-hmm. I mean, the EFF had got the certificate observatory, but nobody had really done much with it. And it wasn't until we did CT that people started to go, well, actually, we can look at all of these things and find out other stuff that's going on.
Sure.
And so it was just the existence of this sort of verifiable source of truth caused...
So would you characterize this as a alternative, not currency-related use of what we call blockchain, and there are air quotes here that you guys can't hear, but essentially... this is a totally different kind of application where we're using, I like to characterize it as one of the tools in the crypto toolkit.
Yeah.
Because, where you and I come from, there's a whole bunch of them.
Yeah.
And going way back, and it's just now that people are starting to clue in, and the blockchain is the first one they heard about, but it's the last one added to the toolbox. And we have so many.
Yeah.
And what I'm hoping, I guess what I kind of imagine is that because of the success in some sense of Bitcoin, it's attracting a bunch of attention to blockchain, which is then getting people into the crypto toolkit. And hopefully we'll get a whole generation of coders out of this who are thinking with these tools and designing and engineering with these tools. And they'll be able to build things that we've always imagined mm-hmm. would be possible. But since there weren't very many people around to do it, it was very difficult to design products around those tools.
To some extent, yes. I mean, I think one of the interesting things about CT is that it uses tools that I invented a long time ago.
Yeah, right.
There's really nothing new in that toolbox. We're not using them for what they were originally thought to be useful for.
Yeah.
So I'm kind of not so sure. And the reason I'm not so sure is that there's so much like fervor around this idea of cryptocurrencies and around decentralization, which I think is actually an impossible dream, that people are really sort of blinded to the true import of these things. And they're very excited about what is effectively nonsense.
They're excited about currency speculation.
About currency speculation, about cut out the evil authoritarian state, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And I think that, that what's really interesting is that if you look at Bitcoin or any of these cryptocurrencies, there's a huge amount of fraud and theft and stuff like that. And, if you look at the history of money and the history of people doing business with each other.
Yeah.
That's exactly what happened.
Yeah.
You started off with this kind of, we invented money, and then people started figuring out how to rip each other off.
Right.
And then people started to go, maybe we should have some rules around this stuff. And gradually we ended up with the restrictive, again, in air quotes, regime around what you're allowed to do with money, censorship, as people like to call it, which really means, controlling how you spend money, making sure it's done in a lawful way and stuff like that. And I think 99% of the people who are excited about Bitcoin are excited about this kind of crypto anarchist dream, and not about the kind of interesting new properties that you can get by using these things in a sensible way.
What I think about it is there seems to be a bit of a maturation process that at least you and I have gone through, and probably other folks too, who first spent a lot of time thinking about these things on the Cypherpunks email list in right. the 90s. And I feel like we're living out a lot of what we were discussing and thinking about in those days.
Mm-hmm.
And at least for me personally, you know, I think I have a lot of those dreams of decentralization in me. They're probably more tame now.
Mm-hmm.
Why do you think that this is an impossible dream?
So I think, I actually recently published a proof of why decentralized consensus is impossible.
Oh, good to know. If it's been proven, I'd like to know.
Yeah, well, okay. I mean, you can argue with the proof. I mean, I think one of the slippery notions in this is what the hell do you mean by decentralized? But I think the core idea that I can somehow figure out what some unknown group of people has agreed
mm-hmm.
is, fundamentally flawed. And it's fundamentally flawed for a kind of obvious reason. This obvious reason is that if I don't know who the totality of everyone is,
yeah.
then I don't know whether I have captured enough of that unknown group of people to yeah. know what the decision is.
Right? Okay.
And so I've got to imagine myself being in this position where I think I've captured enough, but there's somebody else that I don't know about who sees some other portion mm-hmm. of that decentralized group
yeah.
that has captured some other idea of what the outcome was.
Okay.
One of us must be wrong.
Yeah.
Right? And I don't know whether I'm the wrong one
yeah.
or they're the wrong one.
Yeah.
And, I think any argument that says that that's, that there's some way you can make those two things always converge somehow has to rely on us not really being decentralized.
I see.
It has to rely on us being more distributed than decentralized, right?
I see.
And that's all my proof says in a
okay.
kind of mathematical way.
Okay. I'll presume that that's true. I guess the thing I'm curious about is I feel like what was happening, at least in my experience back with the Cypherpunks days, was mm-hmm. we believed that we could embody our values in the protocols. And we believed that crypto was giving us the tools we needed to do that.
Right.
And specifically, the values were to ensure that nobody got an asymmetric advantage on the network
mm-hmm.
and to make sure that everybody got an equal level playing field. And nominally, that's kind of what TCP/IP did, at least compared to other network protocols at the time. And then building on that, I think what we wanted to create, and really part of the reason for so much of the attention going into cryptocurrency in those days, and this is the late 90s, was that we knew we needed a way to exchange money, but where nobody got an asymmetric advantage on it. And mm-hmm. and when you have a centralized mint or somebody issuing the currency, then they get that advantage.
Right.
And so that was the point of trying to emulate some of the properties of cash, the anonymity, And what a lot of the ideas in those days were about around bearer currencies, mm-hmm. where we would, make it so whoever held the pile of bits had the money. And so it would emulate cash in that way. It's just like holding cash. And what we ended up with, instead of like going from double entry bookkeeping to like single entry, which is bearer currency, we went to triple entry, which is what blockchain gives us. But we got this currency that nobody controls. And even though like not none, but that's not really the value that people are getting out of it right now. But in the long run, I at least still imagine and believe that that's important and that we're going to end up with, because of these technologies, because of the crypto toolkit, we're going to end up with some kind of currency that's decentralized in a sense online that nobody has an asymmetric advantage on.
Yeah, no, I think you're right.
Okay.
But I think that the idea that you can do this purely through protocols
okay.
is kind of a fantasy, right? Maybe it's not even a fantasy. I mean, I think it's sort of true,
yeah.
But it carries a lot of disadvantages with it. I mean, cash has nice advantages
yeah.
in that, I can just take a dollar out of my pocket and give it to you and we're kind of done.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, you can lose cash. It can fall out of your pocket.
Right.
It can fall in the ocean. It can all get wet and then I'm kind of screwed, or whatever. And so I think, in terms of putting all of my available assets in something that is so easy to lose is not a great idea. And I think this is why I invented banks and, checks. And,
yeah, that's exactly what's played out.
Bookkeeping and all of that kind of stuff. And exactly.
Because now people have these Bitcoins. They don't even realize that you can download them, put them on a floppy disk, stick it under your mattress, and call it good. They're putting them in something kind of like a bank online, which is absurd to me because those guys keep getting hacked, but that's the model.
Right. But on the other hand, the disadvantage of the put it on a floppy and stick it on the bed is that
can't trade it from there.
If your bed burns, then it's gone, right?
Right.
And do I want to actually tie up significant portions of my asset in something that's so fragile?
Sure.
And it's even worse than that, right? Is that clearly I don't want to just put it under my bed unprotected,
right?
Because then my cleaner can come in and spend my millions, right?
Right.
No, that's not a good plan either.
Right.
So I probably want to actually have it cryptographically protected, and then I forget my password.
Right.
Yeah, that's happened. Right.
Right. So I know I have probably millions of dollars in Bitcoins because I was mining in 2007 or 2008.
Exactly. And the floppy's under you.
It's literally like I have no idea how to get that money back ever.
Right. Exactly. And so I think that this is the reason that we invent all these institutions around kind of safeguarding the value by making it so it isn't just in this kind of bearer thing
that
you can easily lose or destroy or
But okay, fair enough. But the option is still mine.
Yeah.
The point is I can still choose. This is the same argument for any data protection scenario. You have to consider your threat model, consider who your adversaries are, consider how well endowed they are, consider what the actual threat is. And it's a risk management problem at that point. But the point is I have the freedom to choose what's appropriate for me.
But so I think the point is that if I have a system where I can hold the central authorities to account, so where I can see everything that they've done, if they ever break the rules, I can produce a cryptographic proof that they have broken the rules, etc. It seems to me that that is as good in practice.
I see.
You probably want to have rules. You probably want to have ways to get things back that you've lost, that kind of stuff. But I think the fact that you can produce these cryptographic proofs means that actually, centralization is okay because the center is powerless because you have this, evidence that they cannot argue with.
I see.
That shows what they've done and what they haven't.
So if a government were to issue a cryptocurrency in a fashion where I could always see how much was issued, it would essentially eliminate their ability to secretly inflate the currency.
Right.
That's interesting.
Yeah, exactly. And the price you pay for Bitcoin, I don't think people have made really kind of sensible alternate suggestions to allegedly decentralized systems.
Yeah.
And, if you want to put my, in a second I will put my decentralization is impossible argument into a Bitcoin framing, but, leaving that aside for a moment, right now, the cost of doing that is just burning insane amounts of electricity.
Right.
0.5% of global energy production. That is just ridiculous, right? When you contrast it against the alternative, which is, keep Merkle trees, just do hashes, it's super cheap. I haven't actually done the sums for Bitcoin, but having done the equivalent sums for CT, I would be really surprised if, reproducing the entire Bitcoin ecosystem in a verifiable but not decentralized way, I would be very surprised if that actually would cost me more than, one or two CPUs. Instead of 0.5% of global energy.
Right.
And so to put my previous argument about not knowing whether you're in the, the right consensus or the wrong consensus.
Right.
If you think about that in Bitcoin terms,
okay,
the argument is that there's an economic incentive for people to play along with whatever is currently the consensus. So the argument says that Bitcoin mining is at such and such a point, and the ledger says that we've all got such and such money, and we're now mining the next block, i.e. wasting energy to show that we can chain on to whatever has gone on so far. And the idea is that nobody would want to go back five blocks and mine 5 blocks, which is going to cost you 5 times as much energy to get a longer chain.
Yeah.
Because they might as well mine 1 block and get on top of the existing chain. And plus, of course, the problem is that while you're mining the 5 blocks, other people are mining the 1 block, so you have to do it 5 times as fast, etc. But my counter-argument to that is, well, two things, One is, not everyone is motivated by economics. And so just basically saying you would only mine the sensible block because mining the other block would cost you more.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's not necessarily going to, explain why I might mine blocks. I might want to undermine Bitcoin, for example.
Sure.
Another thing is that if you really take this to the limit, the argument that if I do enough mining, I could own all the money in the world.
Yeah.
I could go back and say, everything that you think you've done, all of these transactions, all this money that you think you mined, you didn't mine any of that. I mined it all, and I now own all the money.
Yeah, yeah.
That's a pretty strong economic incentive.
Yeah.
That's worth spending a lot of electricity on.
With Bitcoin in particular, it seems that the technical challenges that come up have to be dealt with by the folks developing the protocol, and they're advancing on it. They're advancing the protocol. I mean, you could imagine at some point even migrating Bitcoin to another design that got rid of mining, or got rid of the current scheme for mining, and get that energy consumption down. Do you think that sort of thing will happen?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I think, there's the idea of currencies that are exchanged in a purely virtual way.
Yeah.
You have cash-like anonymity, but in a purely electronic format. I think they're good ideas.
Yeah.
Like I say, I think the bad idea in Bitcoin is that I should take $100 bills, burn them, bottle of smoke, and say that's worth $100. That's dumb. But I think saying, I have a ledger of stuff so that I can make strong cryptographic statements about is actually a very good idea. And there are examples of theoretical systems.
Yeah.
But not kind of wildly speculative theoretical systems.
Right. Things that just need some work. Things that just need some work.
Not even need work. It's just we know that they will work.
Okay.
Just use hash functions and public key signatures and nothing spectacular.
Okay.
So RSCoin, I think, is an interesting example done by some people at UCL.
Okay.
Centrally banked cryptocurrency. So basically fiat money, but done on a verifiable ledger of stuff.
Sure.
And that's cheap, but it still gives you all the properties of cash if you want it.
Yeah,
to.
Right.
It gives you the verifiability, gives you really whatever you want from a cryptocurrency other than I can get rich by doing an ICO.
Yeah. So. Okay. What about the notion, so in the case of at least Ethereum, the idea was we're going to do smart contracts. As far as I can tell, nobody's doing that, but it has served as a platform to do things like launching ICOs and those things.
Well, and people have done smart contracts, and there's the DAO. That was awesome.
What's that?
The DAO, which is done on Ethereum. I can't even remember what it stands for now, but it was this kind of mega smart contract thing. They had a bug in it, and somebody immediately extracted $500 million. Okay. And that caused a split in Ethereum.
Oh, okay.
Where, one fork is we admit the bug in DAO, and, half, and this all of this chunk of money went to the person who found the bug. And the other one was, I know we backed off time to before that mistake.
Oh, wow.
And we did a revised version of the contract.
Wow.
We just eliminated the contract entirely. So.
I have had blinders on to so much of this because I can't stand the noise floor of currency speculators. It's been very difficult, but now I have to pay attention because it's too far gone. Anyway, so I'm unaware of some of those things. The point I was trying to make is with something like EOS, which is a kind of meant to be sort of a next generation Ethereum, where they want to solve some of those problems technically. I think they really imagine creating a platform, an operating system in the cloud where that database of the shared ledger enables a whole bunch of decentralized applications. And I think people really imagine using that as a kingpin, they're going to be able to take some of these walled garden services that exist in Facebook and Instagram and all these places where it's just, it's not like the internet we dreamt about. I can't get my data. Right. I can't control, I can't do anything with it other than what Facebook wants me to do with it. And so I think what at least some of the more fringe radicals right now are imagining is that the thing that kept us from decentralizing that before was that we didn't have this kind of shared database. I'm curious what you think about those notions.
Yeah, no, I think that makes a lot of sense. I mean, you know, like I say, I think the certificate transparency is you know, an example in a very small microcosm.
Okay.
Where you can apply these ideas to take a system that was, you know, really kind of unaccountable and slightly broken, well, actually very broken in that you were relying on, like, random people who had raced to the bottom in cost to maintain the integrity.
There's like 1,000 root certs in your browser, right?
Right.
So it's like having your 1,000 nearest neighbors have a key to your front door and just saying, it'll probably be secure.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, and it turns out that mostly it is, but sometimes it isn't, and you really don't know quite what happened. Your front door's open.
Yeah.
Stuff went.
Yeah. Don't know. One of those 1,000 people. Okay.
So, you know, I mean, I certainly think that this whole idea of, you know, verifiable databases, I think there's lots of interesting things.
Yeah.
I think not only that you can decentralize these things, well, I say decentralize, I mean distribute, democratize, I guess, is actually a more interesting way of expressing it. Things that have traditionally required some kind of a central authority, some kind of central aggregation point.
Yeah.
You can have these distributed ledgers where you all kind of agree on truth and then you kind of publish it and there's no going back on it, right? And I think you can do those quite cheaply, and I think that there is an interesting future there.
There's a bunch of different things that are going on here, and I think one of them is people are looking at blockchain as a way of, if nothing else, at least spiritually, it's acting as a marker for people wanting to take back the internet from these, you know, huge established players who built walled gardens that where they control all your data.
Yeah.
They control the whole experience.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's not what was going on in the 90s when we were all building web apps and
things. Yeah, exactly.
You know, everybody had an equal footing and nobody has an equal footing anymore.
Right.
Almost everything you do online, you're beholden in some way to Facebook or Google or Amazon or basically those three or Apple. And so there's this kind of feel like I remember, you know, one of the fascinating things was you used to be able to just view source on a web page and see how they did it. I mean, this is always kind of true on, you know, like BSD or Linux or whatever. You're going to go see the source of anything, but for learning how to make things, it's like opening the hood of a 57 Chevy. You know, you could kind of observe it, figure out how it worked. Now, so much of the code is in the cloud. You're never going to see that. So much of it's behind, like, even I remember, like, for us, even in the 90s, you know, I could buy software and I could just look at the binaries.
Right.
You know, I could at least, like, observe the stuff I was running. And now you can't buy anything. Everything's owned by someone else. It's running on their servers. I can't attack anything. Even as a hacker, you can't attack. I used to be able to buy a Cisco router and attack my Cisco router and figure out what's that. I'm not breaking any laws. I'm not messing anybody's stuff up. But now everything's in the cloud. That's interesting. Like, I can't go attacking Facebook or Google or anything
because
it's their stuff, not mine. So it's just very different world that we live in. You know, like, I grew up with Apple II. My daughter has an iPad. Yeah. That's a radically different experience. Like, hers is like a billion times better.
Yeah.
But at the same time, she never gets to see how it works.
Right.
So I don't know. I'm discombobulating a bunch of stuff here. But the point is, you and I grew up in a world where we could learn through this observation, through trial and error.
Yeah.
And I think both of those things have been eroded.
Yeah.
In the world now, you can't observe how things work. You can't get away with trial and error. And, you know, that's not just true for cars, true for everything with all the software, all the computers, all the, you know, the iPad and the cloud collectively take those features of the world away from us. The things we're using, we can't learn them through observation. And so, you know, I think there's this meaningful spirit behind things like EOS, where we imagine we're going to take back Facebook Messenger and make our own that we control. We're going to take back, you know, Facebook's event thing and make it something we control. We're going to take back that feed that Facebook used to elect the wrong guy. And I mean, this I'm making paraphrasing, but you know, obviously that's not what happened. But you know, that's what people feel happened.
Yeah.
We're going to take that back and we're going to make our own that we control. And probably it'll be a market failure for a long time and we won't be nearly as useful as actual Facebook. But that's the sentiment. And I feel like in some cases we've been winning, right? Cypherpunks brought BitTorrent.
Yeah.
Right? Still something like 35% of the internet, BitTorrent, right? Yeah. You can't make it go away. It's decentralized. It uses that crypto toolkit to give us something that we felt was important.
Yeah.
The whole dark web. Yeah. You could argue about the merits of that, but that's cypherpunks making Tor.
Yeah.
Right? And that's descended of things like, you know, Mixmaster and the Remailers and those things. And so, again, that was embodying our values in the protocols. I don't know what percentage of the internet is dark web now. It's not much, but it exists and it's here to stay. You can't get rid of it.
Yeah.
Right? I don't want to make a case for WikiLeaks right now, but you could say same community brings you those things. And then most, and then certainly Bitcoin,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And I think on a long time scale, we are winning a bunch of these battles. Like all the things that we tried to imagine in those days are coming to pass on a longer time horizon.
Yeah.
And decentralized, this is part of why I think, you know, your arguments about making things decentralized, you know, I question them.
There's sort of multiple pieces there, right? I think one piece is around complexity.
Yeah.
So, yeah, the web has not changed in the sense that, yeah, it still all runs in my browser in terms of, you know, the bit that is involved in rendering us.
Yeah.
And, yeah, there's back-end systems that I can't inspect. But when you get down to it, those back-end systems pretty much are just databases. And one of the jokes they say that they make at Google is that, you know, a Google programmer's job is taking one protobuf and converting it into another protobuf. that's pretty much what happens on the back end.
Okay.
You know, all the interesting stuff happens on the front end where you actually render it and active stuff and blah, blah, blah. And you know, I think what's changed there is just that has become enormously heavyweight. Browsers have become super powerful. They have, you know, incredibly fine-grained control on how exactly things look.
Yeah.
And so now if I open a modern web page and say, yeah, hey, web page, what are you up to?
Yeah.
What I get is a megabyte of, you know, JavaScript, and HTML and CSS, and it's all like compressed.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's like super hard to understand what it's doing, but I think that's to do with the complexity of the system.
Yeah. Okay.
And as you know, as you were talking about that, I was kind of thinking that, you know, in some sense, there's like generations of this stuff. So, sure, you know, in the 60s or 70s or 50s or whatever, you could take apart a car. Actually, you kind of, you know, fully understand how the car worked.
Yeah.
But I still couldn't make a piston, you know, at home or any useful part of an engine. There's probably some bits, like some belts and things like that, that I could make my own version of. But even so, I couldn't actually make an engine.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, you know, it's off-the-shelf parts that I could put together. And now we've kind of got to a stage where we're kind of in this, I don't know if it's a permanent end state or whether it's kind of an intermediate state where suddenly we're kind of exposing the atoms.
Yeah.
And we're suddenly going, well, boy, there's a lot of atoms in this thing.
Yeah, right.
It's hard to understand
how
all of these atoms work together. And maybe there's a future where, you know, these things are really super complicated, but they've kind of become like building blocks.
Yeah.
It's like, well, there's a piston. I can't make a piston, but I know how to put an engine.
Yeah.
You know,
I think that's certainly the case. Like, you could go get a computer science degree now without ever learning what a chip is doing or even learning to read hexadecimal because it's just Lego bricks. You know, you're just, you know, in an IDE sticking Lego bricks together. And
yeah, I mean, this is actually one of the things that I think is that, you know, because I kind of grew up in the era where, mainframe computers were big, bulky things
yeah.
that took up whole rooms, but they weren't actually very sophisticated.
Yeah.
Micros were just starting to come out,
yeah.
and they were really at a stage where I could still kind of imagine a bunch of transistors that
yeah.
did the thing that the micro did.
Yeah.
And, you know, if I learned to program an 8080 or a Z80, I could, you know, stick a logic analyzer on it, and I could, you know, actually see exactly what
right.
was on the bus, you know,
right.
look at the instructions and so forth. I actually stuck a logic analyzer on a Pentium 2.
And, wow.
And there was just no way to know what was going on
oh, yeah, right.
the chip because of all of the caching and all
yeah,
that.
Oh, yeah, like, right.
You know, what actually came out of the chip almost no relationship to what was going on inside it. And I did this because I was trying to debug a problem. And it actually
wow.
turned out one of the interesting things about that is that Intel recognizes this as a problem, and you could actually switch all that shit off.
Oh.
So that if you wanted to debug, you're at the hardware level, you could say, hey,
you can shut off the
cache. Stop with all that caching nonsense
wow.
so I can see what you're up to. And then suddenly it became comprehensible again, and you could get your logic analyzer to disassemble and all sorts of stuff, right?
Wow.
With it switched on, it was just like gibberish.
Yeah.
No idea what was going on. And so I sometimes think that I've kind of come from the last generation
yeah.
of software engineers who kind of could see the whole stack.
Yeah,
you
right.
Think about transistors and chips.
Yeah.
And assemblages, these things. And now, you know, as we were discussing over dinner, you know, speed of CPUs has come from Spectre and Meltdown, right?
Yeah.
It's the ability for them to do these really almost magical things with speculative execution and branch prediction and caching and
right.
all of that stuff where
right.
you can no longer observe the outside of the chip and have any idea what's going on inside the chip. And I think
yep.
the same's happening with software to
yep.
some extent.
Yep.
But, you know, again, you could argue that back in the day where I understood transistors, I probably didn't understand how a transistor worked.
Uh-huh.
And maybe
right.
nobody did then. You know, I think mm. we probably do better now than mm-hmm. we did then.
Mm.
It's kind of, it's a thing and it works, but you know, what's actually going on inside?
Right.
I mean, not nobody, but yeah.
Sure.
You know, maybe it's just a question of where do you draw your boundaries? What are the building blocks and what
yeah.
do you understand?
Yeah, no.
Building blocks and stuff like that. I think it's the...
Yeah, I think that's fair. And I mean, and truthfully, like the trend has, you know, apparently always been to use, spend some of this extra computational ability on making things easier
mm-hmm.
for whoever's building with the blocks. And, you know, I keep thinking about, you know, in those days, especially on mainframes and on the early microcomputers and stuff, you had to make everything so efficient because you didn't have cycles to waste, and you had to engineer everything to work perfectly. You had to test end to end. And it's the way we do so much engineering. You know, we try and design things that are perfect. And you look at biological entities like you and me,
mm-hmm.
we're like 99% error correction.
Right.
Cells are dying off all the time, and somehow it sort of mostly works.
Yeah.
And, you know, you're still here. But I think of that as probably the transition we're going through. And now that we have a surplus of computational ability, we're getting to a point where we're just wasting a lot of it on error correction.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll probably get to a point in the future when computers are mostly error correction and they're mostly going wrong all the time. And it sort of generally steers in the right direction. And, you know, I think about, I mean, a lot of the things we have are like that. It's like why, I mean, I remember loading the software to drive an HP printer.
Mm-hmm.
It's like an inkjet printer. And I've got like 600 megs of shit loading on my computer just to run the printer. And it's got like every piece of software on demand. Like there's a database and a web server and all this stuff that's running in the background on my machine just to print.
Right.
You know, and it's just because it was easier to grab these gargantuan building blocks for whoever was making the printer software than it was to think about like what was actually needed.
Yeah.
I think there's a full copy of Apache installed with every HP printer.
Yeah. Well, right. And then people start to realize that maybe that's not such a great idea because you expose this junk.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, you can get all the security flaws too.
Yeah, exactly.
And there's no system update for it.
Right, exactly. So 3 years down the line, your printer is just 100% vulnerable.
100% owned.
Yeah, exactly.
Certified pre-owned.
Yeah. And so then you get this, you know, this cycle of simplification is that, you know, it's cheaper for me to maintain a simplified software stack, even though I do have to customize it more and I have to think more about exactly what goes into it, than it is to deal with the aftermath of deploying this giant mass of crap, right?
So,
I mean, I think there's cycles in all of this stuff. I think it's interesting. But I think, as I was saying earlier, I think there's also cycles around what you consider to be the building blocks, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, we start to get things like, Node. When I first heard about it, that's insane. Why would you want to run JavaScript?
I remember thinking that too.
And then you start, well, actually, if I ignore all of the framework that I'm having to load, this 10 lines of JavaScript does some quite useful stuff.
Yeah.
And I actually understand fully what it does.
Yeah, right.
And that's just like a shift on what you consider to be the fundamentals. I consider the fundamentals to be ZATE instructions. And it's like, well, I included this library that does a thing. And I know exactly what that thing is. So I can forget the internal workings of that library and just... look at the thing that I told it.
Now the building block is like a VM.
Yeah.
It's like, you need to sort. Here's a VM that does sort via, this pretend REST API.
So, I do think every time you go up the stack, there's always a piece that you're saying, don't worry ahead about that, because that's just the mechanism. And the interesting bit is what you did with the mechanism, right?
What do you think are the cool things that we could build, like with the crypto toolkit, that are underappreciated or underrepresented or that nobody's talking about?
Yeah, I think that, the thing I'm obsessed with at the moment is transparency, as I said. I think that...
I don't even know what that means.
Well, so I think that this whole idea of using verifiable append-only ledgers, which is like a really boring tool that, that Bitcoin, as I said, Bitcoin... is half that and half craziness. Yeah. And you can use those to, build a record of behavior of people in a system.
Okay.
And you can have rules about how people ought to behave.
Yeah.
And if you construct carefully what it is you put in the ledger, you can determine whether people have obeyed those rules
or not.
And you can have strong cryptographic proofs about whether they did or didn't behave.
Yeah.
And then you can use them to hold them to account. And I think that, the interesting thing there is that then you start to care a lot less about authorities. This comes back to our conversation from earlier is, we want to not have asymmetric advantage. Nobody in the system should have asymmetric advantage. If we know what the rules are and the people who nominally have the asymmetric advantage have to follow the rules, they don't have any advantage. They're just like machines that we
check the correctness of.
And so that's really what I mean by verifiable transparency is this ability to check that people have done
so we
what
need
to do and hold them to account when they don't in a way that can't be disputed. It's not kind of a matter of opinion. Did you obey the rules?
Yeah.
Didn't you? It's like, here's my cryptographic proof.
Yeah.
And no amount of talking is going to wiggle you out.
So that's interesting. So we basically need to re-architect a lot of the things that we do online with this structure that brings that.
I think the art there is figuring out what it is that you put into these ledgers and how you close that loop and how you make those proofs like watertight so that there's no room for wiggle.
So with certificate transparency, you have a working model of one case where this has been done. What are good candidates for where else to go?
Well, money is another one, obviously. Okay. But I think there's all sorts of things. I mean, if you do, one of the things that we heard about a while back in the sort of, the blockchain frenzy, or almost anything that anybody says, you should put it on the blockchain.
Yeah.
I think is a candidate for this kind of stuff.
Okay.
So things like land registry.
Yeah.
There's a particularly in less first world places, let's say. Yeah, there's a lot of kind of fraud around those kinds of things. And part of the difficulty with those frauds is not so much that they occur, but that you don't discover them until it's way too late to do anything about them. And I think a lot of these things would be much more tractable.
Yeah.
If you kind of, as soon as it happened,
yeah,
you knew that it happened because
yeah,
you could do something about it. I mean,
right,
coming along
right,
in 2 years'
okay,
time and discovering that
yeah,
the system didn't think you owned your house anymore is not all that useful,
yeah,
you know, in those kinds of environments. Whereas if I knew like 5 minutes after the official took the bribe that somebody had taken a bribe,
yeah,
then, you know, I have some chance of doing something about it, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, I think that kind of thing is, you know, where this stuff ought to be going. I think, you know, reducing, which is funny really, because it's kind of the opposite of the crypto anarchist.
Yeah,
view.
I understand.
It's, you know, we don't
yeah,
want rule of law. We
yeah,
just, you know, mass is everything. I don't think mass is everything.
Yeah.
You know, mass gives you a system that is internally self-consistent, but when it doesn't obey the rules, then what? What do I do? I go
yeah,
to the gods of mass and say, hey, give
yeah,
me my Bitcoin.
Yeah, yeah. Good luck with that.
Exactly.
Okay. One of the things I get asked about a lot is so-called cybersecurity. And I think like when hackers talk about, whenever hackers use the word cyber, we have to have like air quotes because mm-hmm, it's such a dumb word. Nobody who's legit at all would ever use that word, but we've lost that battle. So in the case of, you know, we've had all these, what I think is, you know, we've had all these security problems. When you're working on security, part of your job is to become a paranoid and imagine everything that could go wrong. Imagine every attack that could come and imagine every threat. And in some sense, it's sad. I mean, it's turned a lot of my friends into really obnoxious, paranoid people.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not very happy and it's sad. But that said, what I've seen play out over the long, you know, over decades now is all those things we imagined have come to pass, right?
Yep.
All the failures that happen now with DDoS and everything else, like we saw that coming.
Mm-hmm.
And we were right about all of them. But in almost every case, what's happened, as far as I can tell, is shit hits the fan, and then we reboot, we run system update, kick out the bad guys, patch things, and life goes on.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I remember last year with Mirai, the biggest botnet in history at the time, 1.2 terabits per second of bullshit traffic, and it brought Netflix down for like 12 minutes. You know, which, you know, that's like our poster child for catastrophe. And it's not so bad. It's, you know, it's probably a net gain for society that people couldn't watch Netflix for 12 minutes, you know?
Right.
And then, you know, we've had these, even, you know, like all these scary stories, like hackers could get in control of the power grid and shut it down. And last year they did in the Ukraine. And you know what? They rebooted. I mean, they did some clever stuff where they like rewrote the firmware on these USB or serial to Ethernet converters, so they couldn't just reboot. But anyway, the point is, the power grid came back. It's fine. There's a little bit of damage, but I just think people have this almost paralyzing relationship with computer security now, and it keeps them from doing things. And I don't have that, you mm-hmm, know. Like I feel like everything. I just like I've seen it all before. I'm not worried. You know, I'm really not worried.
Mm.
And you know, we're at like full scale cyber warfare, again, air quotes, between nation states. I mean, this stuff is going on and it's all very significant. It does matter. But it feels to me like you build a comfort with it in a sense, and there, and you get like a sense of wisdom about it where you know that it's not the end of the world,
right?
But people are still treating it as if it's gonna be,
right?
I'm curious,
yeah,
you know, what do you think about that?
So, yeah, I think it's interesting, and you know, I like you, I'm not that worried,
yeah.
And I guess, you know, one of the reasons I'm not that worried is that, you know, I've worked in security for a long time,
yeah,
you know. I've worked for Google, where obviously we get attacked a lot. I've
yeah,
some pretty frightening things. And you're right, you know, you figure it out, you
yeah,
clean it up, and you carry on.
Yeah.
I guess the nagging concern is, well, I think there's two things going on, right? One is that we're so shit at building things that them falling apart on a regular basis, regardless of whether they've been hacked or not.
Yeah.
It's just like, it happens all the time.
Right.
And so we're always in this position.
Yeah.
This thing that we thought ought to be reliable just isn't. And, so we're constantly kind of patching up after it's fallen apart around our ears. And sometimes it's because somebody attacked us, and sometimes it's just because we're shit at programming.
Yeah.
And, the reality is that you figure it out, you patch things up, as you say, you reboot, you carry on, and it's all good. And, maybe sometimes you get some kind of outage, and that outage is never that bad.
Yeah.
But I think, the underlying concern is that there could be an outage that is, really hard to recover from. And one of, my sort of nightmare scenarios for security is that we build this stack of software that's so complicated that when it goes wrong, we can't figure out how to fix it.
Right.
And I think we're a long way from that part because we're so bad at building it, because it is always going wrong in this micro scale all the time. Bits of the stack are always falling apart.
Right.
And so we're always like, going, oh shit, that bit fell over and it corrupted these disks over here, and we lost that data.
Yeah.
We'll figure it out. And, I think what worries me more is if we get to the point where it's like 99.99% good.
Yeah.
And then you hit the point one, and then we're like really fucked.
Yeah. it's like, interesting because I remember it was such a problem in the 80s, like if your computer crashed at the wrong time.
Mm-hmm.
But, we solved that because computers crashed all the time. And now they never crash. But I don't worry about it because I know that, no data is going to be lost. Like, the thing is, we solved for that a long time ago.
Exactly. And that's part of my point. In some sense, because, one of the reasons it was a pain in the ass in the 80s, you couldn't auto-save because it's your WordPress going away for like 5 minutes. Type.
You can't type and save at the same time.
Exactly. We built. Maybe that is the trend that will continue. Is that we built this kind of layered defense against unreliability, and we kind of rely on that. Mostly because it's just unreliable, but it kind of saves us when it's insecure as well.
Yeah.
But, we are getting better at being reliable and at having less bugs. And maybe there is this future where we're so good at it that when a bug does hit, it's like horrific. Or it's in pieces of software that have been untouched for 20 years.
Yeah.
And everyone is like, oh, there's nobody around who understands software anymore.
Right. That's probably, like once Dan Kaminsky goes, who knows how DNS works anymore. Yeah. So I get lots of questions from kids all over the world who think they want to be hackers.
Mm-hmm.
Probably because my job seems cool and they want that. I don't know. I don't know what to tell them.
Tell them that hacking's easy and fixing things is way harder. And that's the interesting thing to do. I mean, this is one of the things I've been trying to do with ShmooCon for years. Don't bring me your attacks.
Yeah.
Because attacks are just, any fool can attack a system.
Yeah.
Bring, if you must bring me an attack, then bring me a defense as well. And even better, bring me a defense that is
clever,
that I can, that I can move across systems and isn't just a defense against your particular attack, but a defense against that whole class of attacks.
Yeah.
For a whole class of software and not just the one that you actually attacked. Because I think, it's always been, again, speaking about asymmetric advantage, the attacker's always had an asymmetric advantage. Because, of course, it's the simple truism that to defend a piece of software, I have to fix every bug.
Yep.
To attack it, you only have to find one.
Yep.
Right? And, I just think if you want to be one of the cool kids, then you should figure out how to stop things from breaking, not how to break things.
What about before that? Where to start?
How do you learn?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's interesting. I mean,
How'd you?
I've never been much of an attacker of systems. I've always been a defender.
Yeah.
I don't think you have to. I mean, people often say the only way to learn is by breaking things first so you can fix them.
I think that might be what I said.
I might have
been wrong.
From being the only one. But, I think you can. you can learn by looking at what has worked. You
yeah.
don't have to actually do it.
Yeah.
And yeah, I think you can learn by going, well, how would I stop that thing from working?
Yeah.
I don't think you have to find novel attacks in order to, you know, find interesting sure. things to worry about.
Yeah, sure.
And I also think that, you know, you can think about stuff like, what if I admit that we don't know how to stop attacks?
Yeah.
What could I do about that?
Yeah.
And that's very interesting. So I think it's like principle of least authority, strong compartmentalization. I think things like that are very interesting things that you can do that just are obviously beneficial.
Yeah.
You don't have to know how to actually attack the things that are inside the boxes.
Yeah.
You got to know how to build the boxes.
Yeah.
You know, how do you make those boxes useful?
Yeah, you spend
the fact that they're boxes. Yeah,
so much more time building things. What about, like, I don't know, like high school kids who just don't know what to do with themselves, but they're interested in computers? Can you think of where they should start? Should they start learning math, start learning coding, start learning? What's the place to, if you had to give some advice?
Yeah. So I think the thing about coding in general, you know, even leaving aside security, attacking or defending, is that it's a lot of work. It's like, you know, I'm going to decide one day that I'm going to take a block of metal
yeah.
and I'm going to build a car.
Yeah, right.
I'm a lunatic to do that.
Right.
So I think it's really hard to learn to do this stuff without having some problem that you actually want to solve.
Right.
And so I think, you know, the main barrier to getting into this stuff is having something that you want to do.
Yeah.
And then once you've got something that you want to do, you'll find ways to do it.
Yeah, then it's easy to
things
learn.
That you need to learn. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so, you know, I don't know. So I think the main challenge is finding things that you want to do that are worth expending all of that.
Yep.
Because, you know, writing any serious piece of code is a multi-month piece of work.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
I mean, okay, there are even little toys take at least a day or two.
Yeah, right.
And that's once you're experienced to write code.
Yeah.
By the time you do it, it's going to take you weeks.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's having a thing that interests you.
Yep.
I suppose the funnest thing that you can get into these days that provides lots of challenges and some fun outputs are things like machine learning, right?
Okay.
Where, you know, you can relatively easily these days get hold of toolkits that help you along the line, but you can get fun things out of them in quite short order because, you know, it's all about reward.
Yeah.
Isn't it?
Yeah. So, I think that's the thing that people miss out on is that brains are just optimized for learning things they're interested in.
Exactly.
And so, you know, find something you're interested in and you'll learn a lot. May not be what the school is trying to teach you, but you'll learn something.
Yeah. And I think the other thing is to understand that you're going to fail a lot.
Yeah.
Be frustrated.
Yeah.
And, you know, that you've got to, if you're going to ultimately learn, the way you're going to learn is by fighting through that frustration.
Yeah.
The satisfaction of banging your head against the problem. Yeah, for days, and then at the end of it, solving it is enormous.
Yeah.
I mean, it's incredibly rewarding.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, the days leading up to that reward are extremely annoying.
Yeah.
It's very easy to
you earn the reward. Yeah. Oh man. What are the hard problems left that interest you?
What are the interesting frontiers in software engineering?
Yeah.
There's a bunch of stuff that I'm interested in. I still think that the business of how do you defend against flaky software that you wrote yourself.
Yeah.
Everyone is like, don't write flaky software. That's not going to happen.
Fair chance.
Exactly. So what do I do about the fact that I'm going to write flaky software? You know, how do I try and arrange so that the damage is minimized? I think if you want to get on to more advanced topics, I think a really interesting question right now is that if you look at user interfaces, this is really a pure selfish software engineering perspective, but if you look at user interfaces for all users except programmers have changed radically over the last 20 years.
Right.
As you were saying earlier, you had some crappy 8-bit micro when you were a kid.
Yeah,
probably.
Right.
Your kids have iPads, amazing games, and with Twitter and Facebook and whatever the kids say, I don't even know.
You don't want to.
I probably don't want to, exactly. But programmers are still using like VR.
Yeah, right.
What the hell is going on there? So I think, you know, that's one of the really interesting things is, you know, as a software engineer, how can you improve the life of software engineers, make them more productive, make them actually come up to the standards of interfaces that everyone else
is using. Right.
And, you know, I think machine learning, people talk about neural networks, mm-hmm. and I think this gives this kind of false impression that they have something to do with how your brain.
Yeah, right.
What's going on? There's got nothing to do with
brains
at all. But they're unreasonably effective. And,
yeah.
And they're still, you know, really in their infancy. If you look at mm-hmm. what's happened in the last 2 or 3 years in terms of how people have moved forward on machine learning, they're just screwing around with the kind of fundamentals of it, putting things together in different ways, you know, putting more and more of it together, applying more and more CPU.
Yeah.
And getting surprisingly good results
yeah.
out of that. And I think there's just a huge unexplored territory mm-hmm. in, you know, what exactly you do with these things, how you put them together, what problems you apply them to.
Yeah.
It's a ton of fun to be had there.
Cool.
Yeah. So, yeah.
I'm going to wrap this up. Anything interesting that we didn't talk about that comes to mind? Do you have any questions for me?
Well, actually, I mean, I think the one thing that, you know, we haven't sort of talked about, if we're going to talk about security, is, you know, we've talked a lot about crypto
sure.
and building blocks and what can we do with all those things. And I've talked about, you know, defending against bad programming and stuff. And I think if people get, you know, very obsessed with the tech and with, you know, the cunning crypto that we can use and so forth. But one of the things I realized probably 10 years ago, maybe even a bit more, is that actually most of the barriers to, you know, being good at security
yeah.
are not technological. They're about the interface between humans mm-hmm. and computers. I think we're still incredibly bad
mm-hmm.
at having people understand
yeah.
what the hell is going on. And the traditional reaction of technologists is to go, they're stupid users.
Yeah,
they
right.
should be better educated. They should understand my system better. And that's just wrong.
It is wrong. It's fun to make fun of users, though.
Yeah, it is fun to make fun. But I think that, you know, the thing that we've really done a terrible job on is matching the machine to the human instead of the human to the machine, right?
Yeah.
The user interface is really actually the only serious problem we have.
Yeah.
All of the technological stuff we can do is kind of as nothing compared to making it easy yeah. to use these things.
It's interesting to hear you say that. I mean, I don't think of user interface as something that you work on much.
No, because I'm not very good at it.
Yeah.
I mean, I really yeah. understand that it's a big problem.
Yeah, that's great to hear. Like,
yeah.
I mean, it is, that's kind of my fundamental experience was that I got one of like the first 1,000 Macs ever made. And in those days, it went from the command line to the Windows. And that it became graphical. And the Mac took the responsibility for making it easy for the user. It was the first computer that really did that. And on a command line, you can type any junk you want. On a Mac, you can only give it the commands that are in the menus.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that was a way of simplifying it for the user and saying, here's the available options. And if they weren't available, they'd be grayed out or missing, you know. And that was a way of bridging that gap and saying, we're only going to give you the things that you actually can do instead of just a wide open command line where you could do anything that's probably going to destroy your hard drive. And I think that has always stuck with me. That was the first computer that like tried to operate the way people work instead of teaching people to operate the way the computer works.
Mm.
And yeah, in computer security, like that lesson, I mean, even now, you know, I think a lot of times there's so much bullshit you put up with, even on an iPhone, trying to put, I can't believe how much time I spend putting passwords into an iPhone.
Right. Yeah. So you have the seminal user interface security paper is, I'm awaiting my old boss's paper, Why Johnny Can't Encrypt.
Right.
And then we have, you know, Why Johnny Still Can't Encrypt.
Right.
We have Why Johnny Still Can't Encrypt. It's like, it just goes on forever.
No.
Yeah, I do have a question.
Yeah.
And the question, you know, we go back quite a long way.
Yeah.
You know, our common roots, the security and the cypherpunks and all of that kind of stuff, all of the stuff that we've talked about.
Yeah.
So what still excites you about computers?
Yeah. I mean, when I the way I think about it, you know, I got a hold of an Apple II. At the time, it was a piece of shit. I mean, I loved it, but it had an 8-bit processor that was 1 kiloflop. I mean, I think I could do math faster with a pencil. But I imagined, it lit up my imagination. I could imagine it was going to someday have a faster processor, someday have more memory, and someday it was going to be useful. And I was trying to convince everyone of that. And I've said this before, you know, I had the Apple II and I had a skateboard. And people were very conflicted about which one was a bigger waste of time, right? And, you know, I got lucky. The computer actually turned out to be useful. They did get faster. They did get more memory. And they got to the point where we could use them for all kinds of things. But I'm still living in that. I'm still trying to find new things that we could do with a computer. And I never ran out of steam on that. You know, and to this day, I'm still looking, you know, 10 years out. What's going to be technically possible? What problems can we solve? What can we do better with the computer? And what does it change? You know, so that drives me. That's driven me my whole life. And I don't think that's, you know, I don't see any end in sight for that. And so, you know, I just find different things to aim. And what's great is I know a lot about computers. I don't know a lot about anything else, but I feel entitled to go take the computer and try and apply it to things I don't know anything about. and that's really like, you know, why I spend a lot. I mean, I spend half of my time just trying to learn about the state of the art with new technologies and especially around computers, what they can do. And I just cram that in my head. And then I spend the other half of my time trying to learn about problems and cram them into the other side of my head. And I imagine there's a Rubik's Cube in there that sometimes matches them up. You know, that's literally what I think invention for me is. You know, I'm collecting the tools and I'm collecting the problems. And every day you get a new technology. You get a new chip, you get a new algorithm, you get a new sensor, you get something. And then you get to ask yourself, you know, does this change anything humans have ever done?
Right.
And so that's what keeps me going. Yeah. And I think security and hacking was a great place to start. The irreverence of hackers, they don't give a shit what anyone else thinks. They're not reading the directions. They're breaking things. They're discovering what's technically possible. And that to me is the seed of invention. And that's why I cherish them. That's why I still hang out with hackers, even though I don't really care about security. I'm bored with that. But those are the kinds of minds that I'm really inspired by. And I think it was a great place to come from. I'm thankful that I learned so much about computers, because going deep into something helps you respect the depth of knowledge that other people have in their area. And it helps me so I can communicate with them. So I keep trying to stay up on what computers can do and use that as my tool. So
awesome.
Anyway, thanks a ton, Ben. It's great getting to hang out with you.
And you.
Yeah.